This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. The biography of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart reads almost like a novel. One might think it was all made up, but then there's the inescapable evidence that he did live and breathe and write music unlike anything produced before, during, or even after his lifetime. The story of his final three symphonies occupies a full chapter of this life as novel on its own. More than two centuries after they were written, these works, Mozart's symphonies number 39, 40, and 41, the Jupiter, continue to stand among the greatest ever written. Incredibly, all three of these symphonies were produced in the space of about 9 weeks in the summer of 1788. We don't know precisely when Mozart began writing the symphony number 39, but it was probably around the beginning of June, not quite a month after his opera Don Giovanni opened in Vienna to a less than enthusiastic reception. We know from Mozart's notes that he finished number 39 on June 26th, and then he went on to complete numbers 40 and 41 on July 25th and August 10th. At four movements each, that would mean that, on the average, Mozart took just over 5 days to compose and orchestrate each movement, a feat which becomes all the more astonishing when you consider that he was also writing other pieces at the same time, giving piano lessons, tending a sick wife, entertaining friends, moving to a new apartment, and begging his Masonic lodge brothers for loans to help see him and his family through what was becoming a dire financial crisis. This amazing burst of creative energy masks a mystery, though. Mozart almost never composed without a specific purpose, whether it was a commission or an upcoming concert. Now, there is no mention of these symphonies in any of Mozart's letters, only a reference to a series of concerts scheduled for that June and July, but which never seem to have taken place. Did Mozart write these symphonies for those concerts? Did he write them for a proposed trip to London, as his friend Haydn would do 4 years later? Or was he simply seizing an opportunity to create a legacy, capturing his genius in three grand symphonies, all of distinct character, in the fear that he might never have another chance? We'll never know, but whatever the reason, the result was for naught. There is no hard evidence that Mozart ever heard any of these three symphonies performed during his lifetime. The symphony number 39 opens grandly with a slow, darkly dramatic introduction. Which recalls the overture to his opera Don Giovanni, completed just days before he began work on this piece. Remember this syncopated rhythm in the basses and cellos. It will become even more important later on. The tension builds almost to the breaking point, but then eases into a very short transitional phrase. Which sets the stage for a very lyrical allegro, as graceful as it is energetic. The first movement's two main themes differ not only in melodic character, but in their instrumentation as well. The first is conceived for the strings. While the second is anchored by clarinets, playing in parallel harmony. The clarinet was only just developing into the instrument we know today, and Mozart gave it the spotlight whenever he could. It didn't hurt that one of his best friends and gambling buddies was Anton Stadler, one of the premier clarinetists in all Europe. The syncopated rhythms of the introduction appear again in the slow movement, a subtle adagio in the complementary key of A flat. With a theme in the relative F minor, adding a poignant contrast. Mozart wrote this symphony for the typical small classical orchestra of his time, but in this second movement, he gets even more economical, leaving out both trumpets and timpani. It almost feels like chamber music, especially in the delicate writing for the winds. In a typical symphony of Mozart's time, the third movement is the least deep or memorable, a throwaway minuet that often serves as a palate cleanser between the meatier courses of the slow movement and the finale. But in Mozart's Symphony No. 39, the third movement may be the most memorable. It's an unusually boisterous minuet, a sort of peasant's minuet, similar to the Austrian country dance called the Ländler. The contrasting central trio, though, contains one of Mozart's sweetest dance tunes. A lilting clarinet melody with some unusual and charming echo effects. As substantial as the minuet is, though, it steals none of the thunder of the finale. Mozart bases the entire final movement on a single theme, taking it through all manner of rhythmic changes and interwoven transformations, something very few composers would have tried, other than Mozart's good friend Haydn. At this point, Mozart's audience would have expected a second theme, but Mozart launches into the development section using only that first theme, almost as a boast, just because I can. Each one of Mozart's final three symphonies represents the highest state of the art in that phrase's literal meaning, and yet each one is completely different in character. Number 40 is one of only two symphonies Mozart wrote in a minor key, a score whose overriding emotions range from the unsettling to the downright terrifying, perhaps mirroring Mozart's inner demons and foreshadowing the emotional resonances of the Romantic era. In the Jupiter, number 41, Mozart seems intent on showing off his sheer brilliance as a composer, making a bid for immortality and pointing the way for a young man who had come to Vienna too late to become his student, Ludwig van Beethoven. Perhaps the Symphony No. 39 was just Mozart enjoying being Mozart, the consummate entertainer, reveling in the very act of music making and crafting a score in the height of contemporary style that would not only be a joy to hear, but also to play. For any other composer of his time, this symphony would have been a career-capping triumph. For Mozart, though, it was merely a brilliant prelude, a summation of music's present before two great leaps into music's future. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.